We want to welcome you to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, we are going to play the keynote address from the Missouri Cure Annual Conference held this past Saturday in St. Louis. Missouri Cure is celebrating 25 years of fighting for the rights of prisoners and their families. We hear from Jamala Rogers about her work trying to free those falsely convicted, fighting for human rights, and how our failure to address the problems revealed in the 1960s came back to haunt us in 2014.
But I want to thank CUE for inviting me and to also acknowledge, and I don't know if people understand the true significance of being around fighting injustice for 25 years. Now that truly is amazing, because when you don't have very many resources and you are fighting against a system that we have in place, it takes a lot of grit, tenacity, resilience, confidence, endurance. Doesn't mean you got a whole lot of money, because we don't have all of that. But we can have all of the other things, and sometimes that's even more important than the money. It's the commitment that's going to say, we believe in this, amen, and we're going to keep on doing it. And also, this is an area of work where it's hard to get support. When you talk about lifting up the rights, the human rights of prisoners,
that's right,
folks want to shake their head or go the other way. Here's how I respond to that. Every human being needs to have dignity. Even if you've done wrong, you still have rights in this country. Or so it's on some piece of paper somewhere that says that. So why is it that as soon as we even hear of a wrongdoing, now I'm not even talking about a conviction yet, wrongdoing, that we throw in the towel on our fellow human beings? So one of the things I think we have to take responsibility for, Haiti, and I always say this when I speak to folks doing incarceration work, and in the broader community, is that we have to claim responsibility for some of the mass incarceration. Why do I mean that? During the 80s, when the crack cocaine epidemic was raging through our communities, and I'm particularly talking about African-American communities, what was our response? There you go. Throw away the key. Lock them up. Just get them out of here. Well, they said, happy to oblige. We're going to lock them up as fast as we can, whether they are guilty or not, whether the charge is possession or use or whatever. Everybody got thrown in the same boat. So we saw a ballooning of those numbers that now outstrip any civilized industrial country. And we have no shame for them. There's no shame whatsoever that there's too many people plus in U.S. prisons. But again, we have to go to the roots of that. In our own desperation, and I understand where it came from. You know, we had a community center that was smack dab in the middle of crack houses. So we saw shootouts. We saw young men and women fall to crack cocaine. So we understand where the desperation came from. But the quick fixes is not what we need. We need some thoughtful, deliberate, well-founded, well-researched methods of how we want to get ourselves out of this mess. Throwing away the key is not going to be the answer, because guess what? As soon as we say lock them up, throw away the key, they're coming for our young men and women. And now we're going to say, hey, I didn't need mine. I meant the other one down the street. But when they see this color, they don't care if you're a doctor's son, if you're a crackhead son, it's all the same.
That's right.
This is where the criminalization comes from, y'all. It's not about whether or not you've done something. It's about the way that the criminal justice system, in conjunction and in conspiracy with the media, has criminalized black and brown people.
That's right. Yeah.
This is some serious stuff, y'all. The only way that somebody like me can escape it, because now I've got a little gray hair. But there are grown men that look like Joe who are getting harassed by the police. Now, what's that all about? Because we often think, oh, these young men, brash, whatever. No, that's the majority of them. But when it comes to harassment, when it comes to racial profiling, there's no age. As long as you this color, you are a target. The other thing about brothers who have been victimized, and we talk about this issue, and we talk about even police brutality, there are grown men, 60, 70 years old, who had an experience when they were a teen. And when they start to talk about that experience, they well up. As if it would happen yesterday.
That's right.
That's how powerful these interactions are with people of authority that have a gun on their hip.
That's right.
That has not left their sight. It's still a part of who they are. And for them to talk about it is even painful. So we have folks that are truly suffering from post-traumatic stress based on those interactions. But think about when you're having those interactions on a regular basis, as our young men are doing, as the young people in Ferguson we now know we're doing, as the young people in North County are doing, as the young people in St. Louis City are doing. This is an epidemic of mass proportions that are affecting not just individuals, not just families, but whole communities.
That's right.
So if, in fact, we don't stop the flow into the system, because once I tell young people, once you get in there, it's very, very hard to get out, like a roach will tell. Okay? You're going to go in, but you may not come out. And if you do, you won't come out a whole person.
That's right.
You really, really have to work on staying whole when you're in those hell holes. Because it's designed to dehumanize you and break you down. Yeah. And there's some brothers here that know that. They've served 20, 30, almost 40 years in those hell holes. And you know what it takes to maintain your humanity and your dignity. And it ain't easy. Because the system is not set up like that. So when we talk about criminalization, it's directly related to mass incarceration. Racial profiling, directly related to mass incarceration. So if you read the Department of Justice investigation on Ferguson Police Department, and you saw some of the examples that they used, why are we not in the streets more? So you have, and this is an example that I use in the book, you have a citizen, a black male citizen, who decided he wanted to go to a park to play basketball. When he leaves, he's sitting in the car, trying to recuperate and sweating. Police come across in front of his car to block him from moving. They accuse him of being a pedophile because he's at a park. Before all is said and done, they've charged him with fictitious charges. They've compounded that with other charges and him being able to get a lawyer, be at these court proceedings. He ends up losing a good job that he had. This has happened multiple times. And these are invisible cases because we never hear about them unless they are a loved one of ours or that we know these people. But think about the number of times young people got stopped in Ferguson. But for no good reason other than the police came. So why are people being charged with jaywalking?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You got time to stop somebody for jaywalking? And they end up dead? Again, these are points, y'all, that ought to be just searing through our hearts and souls every time we hear about that, that are going to propel us to do more. And that's one of my challenges here this morning. I wish I could say that the longevity meant that it got better. But now not only do we have a generations that have been through the system. We also have people that are on probation and parole who've been affected by the system. So economically, psychologically, spiritually, there's an impact, there's a cost to it. And if you have somebody on death row, the cost is even more extreme. Because every day, you know that loved one has a death sentence over their head. And there are times you know they're better than most. So she's truly a source of inspiration for us who sometimes want to give up. That's what the system wants us to do. Throw our hands up. And unfortunately, and you know this, that folks have given up that are inside because they see no hope. They don't see any help from the outside. And they keep saying, well, why are you working on that case? And nobody's working on my case. My case is one of wrongful conviction. But it's a capacity question. I know how many people there are wrongfully, got pretty good idea because they now have a little formula to determine how many people have been wrongfully incarcerated. But when you know the likes of Bob McCullough, the likes of Nels Moss, the likes of George Peach, the likes of Jennifer Joyce, those prosecutors have prosecuted people that they know good well that they shouldn't have even prosecuted the case.
Amen.
And I'm not talking about, here's the thing, and you all have heard this before when you start talking about crime, wrongful conviction, people say, oh yeah, you think everybody's innocent. No, I don't. And people in prison, they know when they've done wrong.
Yeah.
When Brother Hardy went in as a kid, he wasn't saying, oh, I didn't do that. No, he said, I'm good for it, and I need to find ways to atone what I did to the people that I harmed. There are brothers and sisters in prison who understand that they did wrong. They need help in figuring out, how can I be involved to do something different and to help these other brothers and sisters do something different. But cure and cure supportive, we don't have to do more.
Yep.
I know you only got a little bit, you've been doing good, but you don't have to do more. And the more really has to do with winning the hearts and minds of our people who think that any black male is a criminal. Which is why when the minute something happens of a shooting, what do they do, y'all? If there's a shooting and we start to get a little upset, what happens? They start bringing out that person's criminal record. And what do? We start backing up. Maybe that's not the case we should be advocating for. That's exactly the case we should be advocating for. That's a human being too. And we don't even know that that person has done the crime that they say they're going to do, which is why we've been doing this for so long. Whenever they say they got a suspect, we say, yeah, really. Mm-hmm. Show me.
Right.
So the person that they got the shooting the person down at the ballpark, you know, they went all out to find that person. You know?
Yeah.
They went after the chief doctor to say, you better get tough on crime because the white person got shot by a black person and we want justice. And they say, and quickly, a suspect. I'm just always wary of that. It might be the right person. He might even confess. But as y'all know, the Reggie Clemens case, I don't believe in confessions. They all are false confessions. Ask the young brothers in the New York Park incident, all of them had forced confessions, spent undue time in prison. And yeah, they got a nice hefty settlement, but so what? The young lives have been ruined. They didn't even get to see the usefulness of their lives. That's the tragedy of all of this. When we rush to judgment, when we rush people through the system, and then find out later that, oops, wrong person.
Mm.
And I can tell you, in almost all of the wrongful convictions in Missouri, not near one of them got an apology from the system to say, we got it wrong, we're going to do better, we're going to put some measures in place so that this never happens again. In Ellen Wiesenhofer's case, the prosecutor said, I still believe she's the murderer. And I'm going to keep the case open so that any time I get more evidence, I'm going to recharge her. Now, that just means spirited, y'all. You already know you made a mistake. But then you're going to hang this cloud over a person's head so that at any given time, she may we charge. This is why the system needs pressure from the outside. We got to get more organized. We got to convince more people that this is a worthy area for us to be fighting in. Because when I look at the room, the statistics say that 1 out of 4 of us got somebody in prison. So why isn't this movement more viable, more stronger, more resilient, and bigger? It's probably the movement that can't have so many people in it that we could be recruiting from because people already know the system. They got a loved one in the system. But yet it's difficult because they've already labeled people criminal. And for us to be associated meant that somehow we're coddling criminals. And we got to debunk that. We got to resist that because we got work to do. 2 million people, y'all. We got more prisons in Missouri than we had institutions of higher learning. All our money is being diverted. Now, if that's not a policy that's unsustainable, I don't know what is. Almost all of the programs that have anything to do with education and rehabilitation have been taken out of the prisons.
Yes,
they're basically hell holes, holding grounds, detention centers. That was not the original intent of a prison. It was supposed to be about rehabilitation so that when these people come back into society, you know, they are be meaningful, productive citizens. In fact, the harsh reality of it is that they want to try to squeeze as much of your humanity out as they possibly can. So that when you come out, you will be of no value to us, for us. That's their plan. What's ours? What's ours? So one of the things that was very inspirational to me, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to, this is going to unfold, but the petition for folks to vote, I don't want to know how important that is, or the fact that it was inmates inside who were the impetus of the petition. And sometimes it's just totally inspiring, because some of us got all kind of freedom sitting on our butt with all kind of excuses. We won't even sign a petition somebody else put together. So here's some folks in prison that said this is an important element for us to participate in the society that we still are citizens. You know, people don't even know that in these prisons, they get counted as part of the census. So Potosi, which is where I go regularly to visit Reggie Clements, all of that population is part of the census. And so you're going to get resources, you're going to get this, that, based on that population of people, including the prisoners. So why don't they have the right to vote? Why? What is the danger, the harm, the threat of inmates voting, to have a say-so, to feel like they're still a part of the broader democracy just because they did a wrongdoing? They're doing their time, but the way the system is set up now, they're going to continue to do time even when they get out. You can't get a jail grant. You can't get a public policy. It is designed to fail. And so when you don't have the proper structure and the proper supports for somebody coming out, what's going to happen to them? If we got a high recidivism rate in Missouri, there's a reason why. There's no supports there for people coming out. Unless you got a really empowered, well-to-do family. But most families out here are struggling. So you got a loved one that's coming out of prison, and you got to hook them up with psychological resources, you got to hook them up with job training. I mean, if they've been away for a long time, they don't know what's going on with the technology. I mean, there's lots of things that have to be done to get them ready. That's our job, y'all. Our job is to continue to talk about this issue and recruit. So here's the thing with the petition. This is a statewide petition. That's going to take a lot of work. Any petition must start off with a good idea, and this is a very good idea. This is an idea whose time has been passed, but we're going to need a whole lot of organization. There are groups who have had the funding, the troops on the ground, and still were shut down. I was a part of the the effort to stop the payday lending and to bring that interest rate down so that people weren't paying like $1,200 interest rate. And we got all the signatures that we needed. But guess what? The powerful lobbyists for the payday lenders, which is some of the most powerful people in Missouri, in the country, decided that let's see what we can do to stop this. So they did a number of things. Before we got to the question of returning the signatures, they had people actually file folks and steal ballots and petitions out of people's cars. So that was happening. These people, when they get threatened, they're unscrupulous. They're not afraid. That doesn't mean that's over. That just means you regroup and come at it stronger and harder. So I don't want people to be disillusioned by defeat. But that's the same thing they told us when we said we're bringing local control back to the citizens of St. Louis. Our police department needs to be back in the hands of citizens. And we've been working on this for 30 years. People, when we started saying, oh, they're not going to let y'all do that. They're not going to let them. We got local control of the police 2 years ago, you know. So don't let anybody tell you what you can't not do. And now, because we knew that not just local control was important, but having an independent civilian oversight board was important, we also just passed the law. If that's going to happen. So, again, don't let anybody throw. They're going to throw stuff out there. We already know that, right? We're going to have to find ways to go around it, go through it, go under it, go over it. But we can't stop. Might slow down a little bit, but we can't stop.
That's right.
So I want us to think about how we're going to grow, cure, so that the folks looking out back at me are not going to be all over 50. I mean, I'm glad that we can be there, but we need to get some young people in here. They're being the ones most affected by mass incarceration. They need to be a part of this movement, and we need to welcome them. We need to figure out ways how to not just bring them in, but keep them in. And there's lots of reasons why they're not attracted to this movement. There's lots of reasons why they don't stay in this movement. We got to figure that out. The last thing I'm going to say is, in St. Louis, there is a mentality, and I also talk about this in Ferguson of America, this sort of plantation mentality where folks are made to stay in their place. So my question always is, who defines what your place is?
Say that. Say that.
Who is going to tell you what your place is?
Tell it.
As a woman, as a trans person, as a black person, as a disabled person, who's going to tell you what your place is? Because they're going to give you messages about what you should or should not be doing. And we're going to have to reject all of that. You know? If we're going to have a truly transformative society that really values everybody, we got to work for everybody.
That's right.
That's what I'm telling the people in the Black Lives Matter movement. Y'all can't pick and choose in this movement.
It's
affecting all of us.
That's right.
You know how many people can be. We got this. Well, they're the people whose shoulders you stand on. Been doing this for a very long time. They might not have always done it right, but the heart and the commitment has always been there. So you need to figure out what you can learn.
Right.
We have not learned a lot of lessons, y'all. We keep repeating the same mistakes. When Ferguson broke out, one of the first things I thought about was the Kerner Commission report. Because in Kansas City in 68, we had rebellions after King was assassinated.
That's right.
And so the Kerner report was supposed to look at, what if all of these cities went up in flames at the same time?
That's right.
And what were the reasons that they went up in flames? There's four main things. What are they?
Economy.
Economy and jobs.
What else?
Poverty. Police brutality is always the kindle that starts it off. And we saw that even with Ferguson.
Education.
Voting. So all of these things were underlying the unrest. And here we are in 2014. No, I'm saying when the mic, everything was going up around Mike Brown, folks went, the very same underlying reasons that people were sick and tired of being sick and tired in 1968 existed in 2014. That's why it wasn't just about Ferguson. There were mass demonstrations all over because the same thing was happening all over.
That's right.
I mean, you can name the names. Freddie Gray, I mean, people whose names now are household words. But why should we know who they are, except for the fact that they were murdered by police? Those were always the straws that broke the camel's back. But it's those other issues, the lack of jobs, the miseducation. Look at the school system in St. Louis. It's unaccredited. Anybody who could get their child out has done that. It's a crippled system, y'all. And it's sad because people pretty much have turned their back on it. We basically say nothing can be done. And all of us, public education is the right, a human right, and we should be fighting for it. Because that's exactly what's going to save our kids from going into the system. When you have kids dropping out of middle school, who say, this is not for me, there's nothing here, I can't deal with the teachers. In many ways, they came out of the blame. Because I don't know what kind of student I would be in a system where I'm being told every day, first of all, you're in a failing school. Second of all, you'll never be anything. I got mine, you don't have yours, so who's the fool here? Those are the messages that they're getting in the school. And that's not all of them. I mean, there's some teachers there, and we know some of them. But they got a hard road to hold, y'all. They really do. It seems like the ones that are trying to do the job are the ones that catch hell from the administration. I mean, this is like unreal. Why aren't they lifted up and say, hey, here's some teachers that are connecting with students, they're doing stuff with students, they're exciting them about learning. By the fourth grade, our kids don't even want to read. They are so sick of the system called education that they don't want any parts of it, and they start shutting down. That, we can't have that. We cannot have that in a society where education, technology, literacy is going to be what drives you as a person who's making a living for themselves and their family. Where do folks go who don't have any of that? So I want you, as I'm leaving the stage, to do a chant with me. And basically it's saying, we must organize and cure the madness. And I want you all to say it so that they can hear you down in the loop. So I know this is supposed to be a place of worship, but we need to raise some hell, y'all. And we need to leave out of here in a hell-raising kind of mentality and mold. So I want you to hear. I don't want y'all talking like I did when they gave an award to Joe. I want some real thunder I can hear. Okay? I think I did a little clap. When people do good, we need to really lift them up. So we want to end, cure's going to end the madness. We're going to cure the madness, and we're going to get more organized. So here we go. Get more organized. Get more organized. Get more organized.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday. Tell somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.